Hi, Avi. Today's topic is about margins, and we joke that most VCs actually don't add enough value. So we've creatively titled this one "Marginal Value Add." Hopefully, it will add some value to the margins discussion. This podcast is something we've been meaning to do for a while, and multiple events triggered this finally happening. Now, this crisis has obviously gotten everyone focused on fundamentals, unit economics, etc. And then Bill Gurley was also in the news this week, and that reminded me of his post from a few years ago, "All markets are not created equal." And then Fred Wilson also wrote this post a few days ago titled "Not all gross margin is the same." So it's very timely, and which brings me to my first question. Is unit economics back in fashion? And looking across the businesses that we have invested in, has the narrative changed?
Yeah. Good to be back, Rajinder. I hope everybody is getting used to lockdown. Sadly, I'm in Mumbai. You're in Mumbai. Saloni is in Mumbai. This will probably go on, sounds like, till June. Getting used to it and figuring out new ways of doing old things. By the way, with reference to Bill Gurley and Fred Wilson, let's include a link to that. All revenues is not equal. I keep sending it to founders and I guess Fred Wilson's post. Is unit economics back in fashion? Yes, probably for another 18 months, then it'll go out again. So, look, is doing what you are doing fundamentally adding economic value? Well, that's probably second. Why do you think it goes out of fashion? It comes back into fashion generally for about a year to 2 years, then goes back out of fashion for 2, 3 years, and the cycle repeats, right? Last cycle was 14, 15. The cycle before that was 10, 11. In both those cycles, unit economics was out of the window. Then 12, 13, it came back. 16, 17, it came back. 18, 19, it went away. 20, it's back. Why do you think that is happening?
Maybe some part of it is just overall funding market linked.
So if you have a business, absolutely. So if you have a business and people are giving, and you have to acquire customers, and that's your metric, and people are giving you money free to give it to customers to acquire them, what would you do?
Load up and take as much as I can.
So look, when valuations go like crazy, funding environment, so I'm going to make a little bit of a controversial and contrapoint. It's rational behavior. Unit economics going out of the window for some period of time, sadly, may be a rational behavior. If I was an entrepreneur, and I've been an entrepreneur, if I was being given money for free in Germany today, debt is being given at negative rates, what would I do? I would go and acquire as many customers as possible, right? So it's actually rational behavior. Has that changed? Of course, because funding environment, I mean, even irrespective of COVID, starting with WeWork last year, funding environment was blowing up. The minute cost of capital goes up, and it'll come up again in the rest of this video cast. The minute cost of capital goes up, you have to see, are you getting the returns for that capital? But if cost of capital is very low, you're not focused on return for the capital, and unit economics is fundamentally returns on capital. So yes, it's back. I'll tell you the only thing that I worry about. When I said it's rational behavior as an entrepreneur, I would do it. Maybe I wouldn't in my current of the maybe first time around I would have, because it teaches bad behaviors both to your customers and to your company. And you start thinking that this is the new normal, this time is different, this is how businesses are built. That's the challenge, right? So I can argue that on a pure financial basis, it's rational behavior because capital is cheap and it's free. And when I say that in the venture environment, I mean you can raise hundreds of millions of dollars at billions of dollars of valuation without real traction, then money is free. But it does teach wrong behavior. So and I don't think you can, it's a switch that you can flip on and off, like you're saying, is it back in fashion? Imagine the pain that the company has to go through. We have seen in so many businesses where excessive subsidies were being given, there's a serious pain at the consumer level and at the company level. So yes, it's back in fashion. It should probably hope. It should be the way that businesses are built. But I could also argue that in bubble times where capital is very cheap, people just go after customers and not building businesses.
No, hear you and see it all around. I think just getting a little more detailed on, you know, definitions here. You know, when people start this whole, you know, valuation conversation, some people started at kind of the revenue GMV, you know, at that line. And, you know, in this environment, you know, people are more focused on, you know, unit economics and margins. But within margins, there's different kinds of margins as well, right? So there's call it take rate or, you know, gross margin in some cases. And then you go down to, you know, contribution margins. Then of course, within that, there's, you know, CM1, CM2. You know, what do you really care about, or what should, you know, founders really care about?
Yeah, so I think we should do some definitions for each. But before we go there, and I guess you can't do it right now on your Zoom, but I would love for you to have Googled IFRS or Indian GAAP contribution margin. All these are gimmickry. All of this has been created by the internet era. If you were to Google this term, the contribution margin in the true accounting and financial sense. By the way, is contribution margin in our sense, and we'll come to our world because we have to live in our world and we have to create proxies. In our world, is contribution margin greater or less than gross margin?
Less than.
In reality, contribution margin is greater than gross margin. So contribution margin is a concept in accounting that says your revenue minus your real variable costs. Gross margin, for example, and in a manufacturing sense, for example, would also deduct direct labor. Contribution would only deduct the raw material cost and maybe the machining cost and stuff, right? So believe it or not, none of these terms are in the accounting or financial world anywhere. Go to Investopedia, and we should include links to this. We should include a link to contribution margin in Investopedia. Google it. It doesn't exist. So it has been invented by the internet era. I use it. You will use it. And the reason we use it is because in the internet businesses, you are often underwriting future cash flows. You are saying kabhi na kabhi paisa banega, because you can't underwrite EBITDA. You can't underwrite that. So in order to get proxies for those future cash flows, all these margins have been created. And frankly, I have learned some of them only over the last 5-6 years from some of the later stage investors who tend to use it more. Because remember, later stage investors are trying to underwrite profitability. And in the absence of current profitability, they need proxies for future profitability. So if I have a one-line description of contribution margins in the internet world, it is proxies for future profitability. Okay. Now within that, let's define. So gross margin, best way to think about it for me is how much hard work does it take to get this revenue, right? If my gross margin is very high, 80-90%, not as much hard work. Or I have created such a value prop that I'm able to really price it way above my cost. And now gross margin is revenue minus direct costs, which would include raw material, like we said, but also things that may not seem direct, so to speak, like direct labor, but it is generally included. Then you have to go to the next level. Now let's say you are comparing an internet company that is delivering goods to you versus an offline company where you're going and buying something directly from the company for the sake of simplicity. In the case where it's delivering, you're paying, the company is also bearing payment gateway charges, they're bearing logistics charges, they're bearing charges for returns, you know, stuff like that. By the way, discounts I have removed at the top level. For me, the net revenue line, there should be a gross revenue line, which should be netted off with returns and discounts, and you get a net revenue line, which is also what people don't do, sadly. So now you go down to contribution margin one, which is gross margin minus these other costs, like logistics, like payment gateways. Maybe sometimes it's related to some cost of returns, but for me, it would have gone above that line. So clearly contribution margin one becomes important. You can have, I would tell you that if you were to sell something below cost, can you have higher market share than somebody who's not? Yes, right? So negative gross, by the way, you will find in the bubble eras, companies with negative gross margins getting. Okay. Next is, if you were to sell something where it costs you more to make that product and deliver that product, but you're still selling it below that cost. Would you have a lot of customers? Yes, you would. Those are called CM1 negative companies. Believe it or not, people still fund them. Next, it comes down to, what does it take to grow this business? In internet businesses, it's generally the variable cost associated with digital marketing. So for me, it goes down below that and says, okay, CM1 minus digital marketing is CM2. And then, not to belabor the point, you take out brand marketing and it comes to CM3, which is contribution margin 3. And then you have your fixed costs. And CM3 minus fixed cost is your EBITDA. So sounds very complicated. If business is at EBITDA positive, none of us would have to deal with this. It is a proxy for these things. Now, my question to you is, which business would you invest in? Assuming you can't get EBITDA positive, which CM do you think you want?
I mean, I would say CM1 makes more sense to focus on early if you believe that the category is one where, you know, the repeat is going to be really strong, because then over a period of time you'd see, you know, leverage come through on the marketing spend that you are spending upfront, and you know you're acquiring users, but you know the repeat will be strong. So I guess that's what most companies today probably focus
on. So in a bubble, so I hear the argument. I think it's a little bit dangerous. So I am a CM2 believer. I'm not a CM3 believer, because CM3, remember, includes brand advertising. Brand advertising, I can see, has very long payback. And I think if you dock a company for that too early, you may not be doing the right thing. CM1 without basically says, I can make money, but I don't know if I can grow. Now, I can see your argument. And I think the way people, I would do that, or way people do that, is then you use CM1 in conjunction with LTV to CAC, right? So if you have very high LTV to CAC, I am okay with CM2 being negative, right? Because you're upfront spending a lot, but your cohorts are very strong. So if you're doing CM1 level investing or CM1 level analysis, please look at cohorts and LTV to CAC. If your CM2 is positive, you don't even need to worry about that, because it's paying back immediately. So that's how I would think about it. So long explanation, but these are all proxies for future profitability, and ones that venture capitalists have to use, because we don't have present profitability.
No, super helpful. You know, one of the traditional arguments against focusing on margin early has been that, you know, margins should increase with scale and with higher market share as you grow. How do you think about that? Is, you know, given the India, you know, context and income distribution in India, and how companies, you know, once you get into kind of the next income segments, you know, can you really kind of command that margin?
So I can argue both sides. I don't have a clear, easy answer, but I think it's very nuanced and situation specific. But let me at least lay out the two sides. So the negative side of saying don't, so if you were to not focus on margins early in the analysis, I question product market fit. See, we take three types of risks. We take product market fit risk. We take scalable product market fit risk. And then we take the scalable profitable product market fit risk, right? Margins are to solve the third issue, right? And you are saying you're solving, if you are focusing early to solve the third issue, you know, it may be incorrect. My argument would be, I may get a false positive on the first issue and the second issue, which is product market fit and a scalable product market fit. If somebody is giving away things below cost and below their ability to make money, they may show a lot of traction. But the minute you switch that off, do the customers run away? Which is why we all know that discount-driven customers are the most disloyal customers around. So therefore, I would say that's why for me, CM1 is a red line. CM2 may or may not be a red line. It depends on LTV to CAC. So if you're asking me to take a CM2 risk, I would want to see enough history in the company to know that LTV to CAC would work out. So the answer to your question is, if you don't focus on these things, are you getting wrong signals on product market? Okay. That's the one side of the argument. The flip side of the argument is, there are things called network effects. There are things called operating leverage. That's the reality of the world, right? So if I look at the Olas of the world, they have serious network effects and operating leverage. I know people think they don't, but the reality is their pricing power, pricing power has gone up at time, right? So where I probably net out is I'm going to look very, very closely at this 10x user experience, network effects, all of those kind of things. If I have to take a punt, that boss margin baad mein dekhenge, right? For that, I have to really believe that this business is offered. This is your classic Facebook's, Google's, so on and so forth, right? Very, very few businesses that are like that. Very few. But if they are, then you're right. Then you should be looking at other metrics which are more user related rather than monetization and market related.
I like this framework, the PMF, scalable PMF, scalable profitable PMF. When should founders start thinking about the third one? What's the right point in the company's journey to start thinking? Should they start from day one or?
Boss, I'll tell you, we have done a bunch of these investments with repeat founders. What is the one thing that we have discussed internally that differentiates them?
I mean, they're really focused on business model and GTM because...
Tools.
Yeah, and
profit. They are chasing large profit pools. Therein lies your answer. And which is why I think, so obviously they are thinking, boss, agar scale ho gaya, if I were to start a company today, I would say, I don't know if I can scale it. But if I can scale it, I better be able to make money. I mean, that would be tragic to be able to scale a business and never make money, right? I mean, airlines is a great example. So I would really say it depends. Now, it doesn't mean that, and I was having a debate with somebody internally, actually, it doesn't mean that unprofitable businesses won't become large, right? Lot of them, the big best venture returns globally have been made on initially unprofitable businesses that became large, but they were generally 10x experiences. And ultimately, valuations are a present value of future cash flows by definition, right? So you really need to believe that the 10x experience is creating moats, is creating network, is creating this. If I believe that, I will not worry as much about profit and I'll say ho jaye. Because if I've really, really captured a user, I'll figure out a way to monetize them. Look at, let's take a random example. It may sound random. Let's look at WhatsApp. It's been covered everywhere that Mark Zuckerberg does not want to monetize it. In fact, there was an article recently that he disbanded the team that was going to be monetizing it. Right? What's he thinking? But look at what has happened with the recent announcement on Jio and WhatsApp. They are finding other ways of monetizing. So if you really have a 10x experience, you will find a way to monetize. Those are few and far between. The mistake people make is assume everything is there.
Abhi, we get this question all the time from founders. How is this company valued at 10 times revenue while I'm being valued at 1 times revenue?
So I think, look, going back to our margins discussion, there is a very, and this might be a slightly longish answer if others want. What are businesses that are traded in the public market ultimately valued on, in your view? What is the stock price?
Earnings, free cash flow, like in...
Stock price in finance 101 is present value of future cash flows. You don't know future cash flows. No individual investor can figure that out. Actually, no institutional investor can figure it out. So the proxy that's used is price earning multiple. Price earning multiple, as an aside, is actually benchmarked to interest rates that exist in the treasury market. Just people may not know this, but which is why when interest rates go down, stock prices go up, because E by P is the yield of a stock. And P, so inverse of P is the yield of the stock. So minute interest rates go down, yields, stock prices go up because people hunt for higher yields. So now, how is this relevant to venture capital? None of these companies have E. How do you value them? So again, people start going up in the P&L and start looking for proxies to value them. There is that saying that revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash flow is reality. The reality is, in our business, we move away from reality towards vanity. And in the worst of the bubbles, you actually get GMV. People, I mean, I have lived through the dot-com bubble as an investment banker, where we were valuing things of unique users, right? So that's the ultimate of a bubble. And by the way, that's a great indicator. As you're watching valuations, and when people start moving away from cash flows, earnings, to start talking about other things, you know a bubble is just inflating. So when companies, the simple rule, very keeping it very, very simple, and people shouldn't think that this is technically accurate because it won't. Companies are valued at generally 1x their growth rate in PE. Okay? It's called the PEG multiple. And a PEG multiple of 1 is the simplistic way of looking at it. So you can assume company growing 20-30% will be valued at 20-30 PE. Now you look at the margin of that company. If the margin, if the PAT margin, profit margin is 10%, you multiply 20-30 by 10%, it's 2-3x revenue because PAT margin is on revenue. If that company is growing 30-40%, you can make it 3-4x. But remember, big assumption, growth rate and PAT margin, the margin. Now, because I don't even have PAT margin, I have to keep going up in my income statement and take proxies for that PAT margin. Okay. So what people they do, they go all the way up to revenue. And what generally happens, what I find, which is the whole Fred Wilson article now, is gross margin tends to be the convergence. So if you say 8-10x gross margin, because it's a proxy for what will flow through the income statement and now PAT margin, you are kind of going to converge on the revenue multiple. So when you tell me a company is valued at 9-10x revenue and it's growing fast, my guess is that company has 80-90% gross margin. When you tell me a company is valued at 1x revenue, my guess is that company has 10% gross margin. And that likely means that the company is calculating or using GMV as a revenue metric. And the 10% is the take rate. So I think the single convergence for me, what I have started using, is 8-10x gross margin is where value, which is why the quality of revenue is critical. This is for companies that can grow 40-50%. Your company is growing faster, dial this multiple up. Your company is growing slower, dial this multiple down. Bubble environment, dial the multiple up. Bearish environment, dial it down. I think that's how I look at it.
So some models earn more margin because they are more full stack. And you know, to create that 10x experience, you might need to go full stack. How do you triangulate margins and multiples then in the context of, you know, capital intensity? Because going full stack sometimes means doing things which, you know, require more investment upfront.
Yeah. So now we are going to take this to the kind of the holy grail of finance and investing, right? Even a price earnings multiple that we spoke with so much sanctity and then we moved away from it to come up with proxies, even that's a proxy. The real value of a company is its return on equity. You are giving me 1 rupee. I mean, this is, if you were investing in a company, which is, if you're putting money in a bank, you get your fixed deposit rate. And we discussed earlier, which is why these things tend to be so benchmarked to interest rates, right? You're getting your fixed deposit rate. If you're giving a company money, you want to see what that company can earn on it. That's not price earnings. That is return on equity. If I put 1 rupee, into the company. The difference between equity and price earnings is one is market cap and one is net worth. One is called book value and one is called market cap. Right? So complicating, just putting one thing out there, P is equal to P by B into B by E, right? Which is, so that is your price to book multiple and divided by your return on equity. So why does it matter? Why it matters is the question you ask. There is a link we should include to another finance term, which is a DuPont ratio, which is how does a business actually make money through margins times asset turnover times leverage, right? So the answer to your question is, if you give me a business that's very low margin, let's say it's a 10-15% gross margin, and this connects back to Fred Wilson's email. when does that business become an investable business and generate enough return on equity? When its assets can turn very fast. Or if it can add leverage, right? Leverage is scary. I'm not going to go there. Although NBFCs kind of work on that principle, but they are regulated. If you look at a business like Country Light, it's a low gross margin, although it's still 35-40% gross margin. But if you were to take up staples, groceries business, it'll be 10-15% gross margin. How many times do you buy groceries? Probably 6-7 times a month, right? In your case, might be 20 times, but I'm just kidding. That's the key. Why do Kirana stores make sense? They don't make that much margin, but the things turn very, very fast. And which is why things like JioMart and some of these things coming in, imagine what it does for them. Inventory goes down, turnover goes up. Return on capital. The capital is cycling very fast, right? So businesses that are low margin can make good return on equity if the asset turnover and inventory turnover is very, very fast, right? Your capital is turning very fast. If I'm making 3% a month for 12 months, I'm 36%. I might be better off and compounded, but whatever. So in those kind of businesses, you have to just, and I think you've said this about 10x experiences before, you have to just believe that your experience is such that people will keep coming back. And Kirana stores, by virtue of geography, they build close connects. But the Ola Uber business model is that, right? 4, 6, 8 times, and they are making much higher margins. Turning, ultimately, these businesses will be very profitable.
Yeah, that's a good point. Continuing with that train of thought, you know, there's new generation of marketplace models that are emerging where, you know, margin expansion actually happens through a variety of additional services. Could be credit, could be software, could be subscriptions, could be, you know, variety of things. Once you have the user, you can, you know, add more.
It does. It changes how we look at things also. But I would like to bring everything back to first principles and what we have discussed. And let me try to do that, right? We discussed that in the worldview of CMs, CM1, CM2. I prefer CM2. You say if CM1 is good enough. So we said, okay, CM1 plus LTV to CAC. If you have a business like what you just spoke about, it has no revenue. So there's no CM1, CM2, whatever. LTV to CAC. There's no LTV, but what's the CAC?
Really low, hopefully.
So that's how I get there. Which is, if you have a business that's on fire, if you have found some thin edge of the wedge in the market, where you are able to get customers for free or very close to free, I'm going to take the punt on monetization because you're doing something right. You're doing something that is, so if you show me no LTV, I'm going to say, please show me no CAC. If you show me a business with zero CAC, I'm willing to take a punt on LTV. The problem is, in the bubble days, people have CAC and they have no LTV. Mm-hmm. And then you're taking multiple punts, which personally I would never be comfortable with as an investor and would not advise as a founder either. But I do believe that there are a lot of businesses. And by the way, history, Facebook, completely viral social network. WhatsApp, I mean, it still doesn't have LTV, but it's zero CAC. How many times have you seen WhatsApp advertising anywhere, right? So zero CAC businesses probably are some of the most powerful businesses in the world. And they are called viral businesses and stuff. So if you have a zero CAC business, well, you probably don't have a business, you have a product, but if it is zero CAC, I think you can build a business. But make sure that your moats are going up as users are coming in. And again, they tend to be more network effect like WhatsApp.
No, this is really, really helpful. Thank you for doing this, Avi. So just, you know, wrapping, I think not all margin is equal, not all revenue is equal. And hopefully the marginal value add that, you know, this conversation has added to, you know, the Matrix Moment series is appreciated by founders.
Yeah. And I really hope that, look, in this environment, everybody will listen to it, nod their head and all of that stuff. I really hope that, you know, when we are back in the bubble era, we come back to this and people come back to this and just keep those fundamentals in mind. Because, see, Warren Buffett says this, right? There's price versus value. Price is not value. We often confuse the two. I think these kind of frameworks just help you understand how far you are, you know, in that. And that, at least as an investor, definitely helps. But I think as a founder is also critical.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you for tuning in. And you can find the transcribed version of this podcast on matrixpartners.in. You can also follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn for more updates.